Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable panel for this Wednesday, the 28th of April. Wacky Wednesday. And I only say that because Mike Bowen, who is our wonderful engineer, and I were talking to each other in the callback. So I'm in the studio and he's in the control room. And then we talk back and forth to each other. And for a really long, sustained period of time, he was doing a Yogi Bear voice and I was doing Boo Boo. I don't know why, but that happened for a really long time. Let me also just say for the record, Mike does a really mean Yogi Bear. So we may want to keep that in mind for future broadcasts. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. It's a delight to have you all here. We are very thrilled. We are thrilled that you are with us. We have a good group, and I thank you all for being here. Panel at WAMC.org if you'd like to be with us. Panel at WAMC.org. You can write in your thoughts, your questions for our panel, and we'll get going. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm fine, Joe. I'm ready to roll and rock.
Excellent. We're ready, too. We'll go. Bob Griffin is with us. He's the Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany. Robert Griffin, good morning.
Good morning, Joe. It's great to be back. I've missed the last couple weeks, and I brought my picnic basket.
Thank you. Good. I'm glad. We could keep this up all morning long, much to the chagrin of listeners. We also welcome Rosemary Armeo, investigative journalist and UAlbany journalism professor. Good morning, Rosemary. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, but I don't do bear imitations, cartoon bears.
Okay, that was a classic. Was it Don Misek, right? Don Misek was the voice of Yogi Bear and Boo Boo, I believe. The only person probably on this panel who knows that is lecturer and adjunct professor in communications for SUNY New Paltz and RPI, Terry Gibson. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Oh, yeah, I definitely knew that. Absolutely. Who wouldn't know that?
It's good to have you with us, Terry. Thank you very much. That's our group this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Let us begin and talk about the new CDC guidelines, which were released yesterday. Very interesting to know what we can do and what we can't do. So the CDC said that fully vaccinated people can go without masks outdoors when walking, jogging, or biking, or dining with friends at outdoor restaurants, a milestone development for tens of millions of pandemic-weary Americans after more than a year of masking up and locking down. The key term in what I just read seems to be fully vaccinated people, but we'll see how that plays out over the next several weeks and months. President Biden touted the relaxation of restrictions as another reason for people to get vaccinated, urging them to move forward, not just to protect themselves and those around them, but so they can live more normally by, quote, getting together with friends, going to the park for a picnic, or picnic, and doing so without the need of a mask. Biden has set a July 4th date as a target for when people could get together for backyard picnics with a sense of normalcy. And both the new mask deadlines and his remarks were geared to encouraging people to continue to get the shot, to become vaccinated. Alan, what do you make of this news?
Well, it is to his advantage to show the American people, he's going to say it tonight too, of course, that we've made real progress here. And I'm sure we have, because a good deal of the country is now being vaccinated. On the other hand, from a personal perspective, I ain't doing it. I'm going to wear my mask. If I see somebody coming at me with a mask, I'm going to pull up my mask and I'm going to do that. It may be a little bit on the paranoid side. Nevertheless, I think safety comes first. Then the second part of this that is so difficult for me is we don't know how long these vaccinations are going to last.
Right.
We really have no idea. We're hearing about that we're going to have booster shots, and we're going to hear 6 months from the time you're vaccinated. I don't have any idea whether that's right or not. All I know is that this is a difficult time for a lot of Americans, and I'm going to always be on the side of caution.
I got out of the car this morning to pump gas, and I realized that I now, under CDC guidelines, do not have to wear my mask while I'm pumping gas outside. but I had to wear it. I just feel weird not now, I think.
Exactly.
Bob, what do you make of it?
A couple things, Joe. And I think Alan's spot on in this morning under your comments, Alan. I thought you were really it was very you were direct and correct when you said that we need to be prudent. There's also a concern, a growing concern that I have about how many people are not getting their second shots. So let me sort of put that in the category of I'm concerned. With that said, I'm really glad that we're following the science. And I'm actually okay with the CDC trying to ratchet down on the restrictions. It still comes back to what Alan said, though. You have to use common sense. You have to be prudent. And you have to remember, if you're out without a mask, you can't go into a store. You can't go into inside buildings without it. So always bring your mask with you.
Right. And you know, and I also, to Alan's point of, we still don't know about these variants. We still don't know about the lasting, how long these are going to be, are going to last. And the other thing, too, and this goes into, Alan, I agree with you on the paranoia front. But if somebody's walking down, like, say
you agree I'm paranoid.
Well, yeah, I agree I'm paranoid in the sense that I'm paranoid because if I see somebody walk down the street and they don't have a mask on, I don't know that they are, A, fully vaccinated, or B, don't believe that they should be wearing a mask. And,
exactly.
And I don't get that, quite frankly, of how you regulate that. I know you can't. Rosemary Armeo.
Well, to tell you the truth, I actually thought we already were allowed to do this. If you're outside, there was nobody around you. I already thought you could do it. The CDC continues to confuse me by shifting the rules, and I was further confused by this. I were downshifting, but how? I mean, I thought, as I say, that we could have done this. I wear a mask when I'm pumping gas. But I'm also throwing a big outdoor party this weekend, and I've asked people to bring masks, even though most of them, if not all, are vaccinated, just because be prudent and because I'm not a crazy Trumper who thinks it's some expression of freedom to not wear a mask.
When you go and you look at this, I mean, those are sort of your options, right? I mean, you know, you don't want to, you're either following CDC guidelines or you're a crazy Trumper. And that's odd, but that's where we are at this moment in time. Terry Gibson.
Well, it is interesting that there are these extremes when it comes to this whole issue of mask. And you know, so much of the conflict in our country today has been around whether or not you believe science. And we have seen much of the Trump base really be in denial about science, whether it comes to wearing masks or whether it comes to climate change. And I just think that we have to, as everyone says, use common sense. We have to be careful. The way I look at it is if we can trust the science that went into deciding that it was okay to inject our bodies with a fluid that is supposed to help us, and I've done that, and I think all of you have done that, if we're willing to trust that, then we have to be willing to trust the science that says that we don't have to wear a mask in certain situations to some degree. Otherwise, we fall into that extreme camp of ultimately denying science if we're not careful. So I think it's a balance. I think common sense is obviously a part of it. And I think it's about who you know and where you are and how comfortable you are in that situation. And remembering that, you know, life is full of risk. I was looking it up this morning just to remind myself that according to the CDC, 4.4 million people need serious medical attention from injuries every year that they get in car accidents.
Right.
38,000 people die a year in car accidents. So even just leaving the house to go to the grocery store, masked or unmasked, if you're in a car, comes with risk. And I think we just have to keep it all in measure.
I want to go back to what Rosemary said a moment ago, because I think it's a really good point of, you know, you thought this was the case already. And in some cases, I did, too. It speaks, doesn't it, to what we know and the confusion that comes. And I think a lot of this is media based, too, in my opinion, that they add to the confusion because you get so many different reports and it gets kind of conflated with what should be in recommendations and so forth. But that's hard to figure out, isn't it, Rosemary?
Yes, I think so. The media probably is to blame, but I, of course, as in everything, go back to Trump when it comes to blame. I think the CDC was captive under his administration and trying to kowtow to him and trying to sugarcoat for a long time. Plus, there was some confusion by the scientists and themselves. If you remember, masks at first were not seen as something necessary. Remember that? It would help other people, but not you, so why bother with it? So the science changed, the government was obstructionist, and the media was trying to make sense of it all. No wonder we're all confused.
Alan?
You know, that's a very interesting point that Rosemary's making. I think that there's science and then there's science. There's science when you can prove something. But when somebody at CDC says something, that doesn't necessarily, or a politician says something, mean that it's scientific. It may mean that it's helpful to them at this point. I think Joe Biden is very much helped by saying you can not wear a mask in a particular situation. But I would be very careful about the use of the word science.
In Joe, you know, it's in following up on Alan's and Rosemary's point, you know, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics, and it applies to science too. You know, we're constantly learning more, and everything that we do is an inexact science, and inexact in the sense that we don't have perfect answers. So I just view this as part of the continuum of how we learn, and the more people that are vaccinated, the more impacts we see, the numbers, the trend lines. This all gives us a clearer picture. I'll also note, and I was a bit offended by Senator Rand Paul's comments going after Fauci yesterday, saying that he's flip-flopping. He's not flip-flopping. He's just bringing more data to the table and giving their best, frankly, knowledgeable opinion. But again, scientists are not omnipotent, and science will build on its own knowledge base, which is exactly what's happening.
Terry?
Well, I think it always just goes to the credibility of the source of your science. There are people using, quote, science today to make a case that the world is flat. And there are people that are using science today to make a case that the world is round. I think it all comes down to the credibility of the source itself. I tend to believe that the credibility of the current administration in our country and the current leaders of the CDC is very high. And I tend to trust what they say, although, again, I think common sense is in order.
Let us go to – go ahead, Rosemary.
Wait, I just want to add that to Terry's point. Don't you want to know who the political advisor is to Senator Paul, who was saying, yeah, make Dr. Fauci your enemy. That's the guy you want to go after. I surely don't get that. I mean, he just can't measure up to the guy of expertise in infectious diseases. And what's really at stake here is that it's just like doctors. They're experts, but that doesn't mean they know everything. And they just didn't know about this disease. And we want answers from them that they cannot give. And because, like doctors, they act wiser than they are because they want to be reassuring, we've ended up getting some information at the beginning that just simply has been outrun by the data.
I know.
Yeah, that's
human.
That's right. And we still don't know so much. I mean, every day we're being told something different. So, for example, now we're hearing that, you know, we may have to change our minds about how long the vaccines will last. We just don't know the answer to that. You're so right.
Yeah. It's like, is coffee good or bad for you? Should you eat eggs or not? We don't know. And how can you say one thing is scientific and the other is not?
Yeah,
it's a good point. I mean, but as far as to your original point about Rand Paul taking on Fauci, I mean, in I don't know if there's a recent study being done, but in polls at the end of the year, he was the most respected American.
Fauci.
Yeah, by like 94% people respected this guy.
It does seem like they don't like that.
It does seem like an odd villain to pick on.
As for me, I'm a big fan of Rand Paul's neighbor.
Yeah. Yes.
And remember, Joe, politicians are just people.
Yes.
And it could be just that Fauci's PhD and MD is better than Rand Paul's, and he's jealous. I mean, I hate to say it comes down to some, you know, sometimes it's the simple things that make the most sense.
Yeah, but don't you think Rand Paul was after the Trump vote as much as he can get it? So that means the more right he goes, the better off he thinks he is. So it has a lot more to do with politics' attacks because of Fauci, after whom we know that there are dolls, Fauci dolls, and everything, including one in my room. That's
not weird.
That's not creepy at all, Alan.
Alan calls it Tony.
You people keep trying to make it into something that it's not. I mean, I just got a Rand Paul doll for a gift.
Although it would be fun to have a Rand Paul doll and just have the two like bicker back and forth. Yeah, that would be fun. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will continue our conversation. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Bob Griffin on the program this morning. We do, again, welcome your thoughts. We're going to go to a BBC news break and some messages, and when we return, we'll go back to this topic and welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A couple of letters. This one from Jules, who writes, "Are we forgetting why we wear a mask? Principal reason is to protect others from our possibly contagious particles from coughs and sneezes. Secondary reason is to reduce the viral load, not eliminate, but reduce the viral load we could be exposed to from others." MJ writes,
Jules is a very scientific fellow. I know him. However, I've always believed it's a rather matter of outgoing or incoming. I mean, the mask has got to stop something from coming into your face, doesn't it?
I would think so. I've seen those. I've seen that animation. It looks like it does. They show that pink mist, and only half of it goes through the. Anyway, Tom writes. If everyone was as quote unquote paranoid as Alan, how many fewer cases of COVID infections would there be? Significantly fewer. We all need to be adults about this and be super careful. Alan's level of concern may be on the fringe of the bell curve. Well, that doesn't seem nice, but he's right, and I'm right there with him. Bell curve, schmell curve, as Alan would say. Let's continue to protect ourselves and others as we have been. And that's kind of the issue, right? What's so bad right. with just staying where we are until we know what's going on?
Yeah, especially Joe, we've made such sacrifices over the last year plus, and I hate the feeling that we're dropping the baton right before we cross the finish line. So I mean, let's finish strong, but you know, let's also understand that help yourself and help everybody else as well.
Of course, if you're a politician, right, you're between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, you know, the restaurants can't open the way you'd like them to open. You're getting a lot of heat, and people want to go back to the way they were. I want to, like a two-year-old. I want to.
Right.
And then, on the other hand, you know what's right. So you're a politician, what do? Now we see all kinds of politicians, Andrew Cuomo is one of them, saying, okay, let's open things up. I don't know that that's a good idea.
We go to, Terry, were you going to say something?
I was just going to say, I mean, it's just important to remember that part of this too is an effort to try to encourage those who have not been vaccinated and those who are continuing to resist vaccination to get vaccinated by showing that there is a payoff, that there are things that you would be allowed to do that you can't do now. I don't know if that's really going to motivate them, but I just think it's important to remember that that's part of what went into making this announcement.
It's a fine point. We go to this letter from Emily. My recollection at the beginning of the pandemic was that because of the extreme shortage of masks at that time, scientists and doctors, as well as governmental officials outside the Trump sphere, wanted to ensure that frontline workers in emergency rooms, hospitals, etc., could have access to masks that were considered the most effective against the virus. As someone on the panel said, the science surrounding the virus was constantly changing as they learned more. I also remember that many people stuck at home started to make masks to give away to those who still had to work and weren't able to find masks in the store.
God, that feels so long ago.
It does. It really does.
Now the masks are like fashion items. They're everywhere and in every design and pattern. But yeah, I remember those days.
Jim writes, I was go ahead.
But you know, if I could though, Joe, and you know, the letter writer is correct that there was an absolute lack of personal protective equipment, PPE. And I think if we get to the story about India, that's going to come back again. But you know, you think of the first responder community burnt through, you know, a year's worth of supply in weeks just because of the type of call volume. So it was intended to try to prioritize, and basically it was a risk model.
Jim writes, I am equally baffled by the person who walks down the sidewalk by themselves or is driving their car alone with a mask on as I am by the person who walks into a store or crowd without one. There seems to be no nuance or indeed understanding of the risks to catching COVID among a significant segment of the population, even after a year of it. But doesn't that get into what we were just talking about of the overall confusion?
It does, but I mean, also realize I do it at times too, just because I forget I have it on, which I think is a good thing. And you know, I've seen people driving with it, and I have thought the same point, but then I realize that some of them are you know, driving for Lyft or Uber or in a position where they may be interacting with people. So we should be a little cognizant before we, you know, about what other people may be doing before we criticize too much.
All right, we go to.
Well, I will go back to the CDC confusing people. I mean, it seems again. I feel like coffee. Drink it whether you know it's good for you or not, because they don't really know. Do you remember? Oh, you can't hang your mask on your rearview mirror because it'll get polluted. Oh, you can put it in a plastic bag. No, that's no good. It has to go into a paper bag. I was just convinced at one point that you don't touch your mask. Wash it every day. Don't wash it. Throw it away and put on another one. Really, I don't know what the rules are, and I read a lot about this stuff.
That's a great point. I mean, we've even seen the same thing right about surfaces. You know, wipe down the surface, don't wipe down the surface. There's very few cases that come from that. Yeah, it is. That all is confusing too. And again, not to blame the media on this, but you know, they report on studies that come out from very prestigious institutions, and then they also report on what the CDC says, and there is disagreement. So you do end up being confused as to what is right and wrong. Let's go to this letter. MJ says, the science says I can walk the dog in my Brooklyn neighborhood without my mask, and since I'm 2 weeks plus past my second vaccination, I'm going to follow it. I agree with Terry, but I completely understand some people's trepidation. However, I'm not going to be imposed on, but the crazy Trumpers who have created this fear factor. I think I understand.
I don't get it.
I guess what he's saying is if he's walking his dog down the street and there aren't a lot of people around, he feels comfortable not wearing a mask. And I think I would too. If I was walking my dog through a crowd of 30 people that I didn't know, I would put a mask on. So I think it's, you know, it's just about common sense and what the environment is at the moment.
It's also about what Rosemary was referring to with the coffee analogy, and that is we don't know. We just don't know.
Well,
you know, anybody can say anything they want, but we do not know.
We don't know. And also, I want to get back to the earlier point that was made that we don't know, but we also, the key line to this, as I mentioned, the key line is that fully vaccinated people can walk down the street walking their dogs without a mask. So are you right in assuming that the person coming down the other side of the street not wearing a mask is a fully vaccinated person? And I don't know if I'm comfortable making that assumption.
Well, the other thing the CDC has said is that if you're just casually, quickly passing by a person or a few people, that the risk continues to be very low if you're vaccinated. If you're stopping and hanging out with those people, that's a very different thing. So again, I think it depends on the circumstances.
Alan?
There's a whole new etiquette developing about how you deal with issues like this. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Rosemary.
I'm sorry. I'm just struck by how people don't quite know how to negotiate this too, figuring out if somebody else. The other day, I took my mother to a restaurant. The restaurants actually have waiting lines now. And I put her down on a seat because she's old. And we were definitely too close to another family there, a young couple with the young children. And the guy was concerned about this. And I know this because he sat there muttering as if to himself, but loud enough for me to hear, saying, some people don't know what a distance is. They don't know about social distancing. And so I spoke up and I said, I know we're too close, but we have to sit down and we're fully vaccinated. I think you're okay. But, you know, he didn't want to confront me, but he was concerned. And I did not react like a Trump or jerk and yell at him for this. I understood the concern. We are learning a new way to talk to each other over this politicized public health war that we're having, we seem to be having.
Or not talk to each other. You know, that's an old trick, this business of just talking under your breath. I have a relative who is very good at it.
Yeah.
Talking under your breath. Okay, it was my mother.
Sugar writes to us and says, I can't know who is or isn't vaccinated. That allows anti-maskers to be concealed in the crowd who are vaccinated. I won't feel safe without a mask in this fog of who is or is not. And that's what we were just touching on a minute ago.
Think about it. You're walking down the street. You know, this business about if you're just passing, it's probably okay. But you're walking down the street and all of a sudden somebody goes, achoo, and you know, basically puts their stuff into your face. Doesn't matter whether you're just passing them. That's pretty threatening.
Their droplets are your droplets.
Well, we have to remember, too, though, that we did used to live in a world where we would walk down the street with people sneezing and coughing.
And we got the flu and we got sore throats, and we haven't gotten that in the last year and a half.
Yeah, or we didn't get the flu, or you know, you didn't always get the flu when somebody coughed. And I mean, we do have experience of living in a world where we're able to control disease without masks. But I just think it's interesting to reflect on those times.
Terry, what's your point? What is the point?
I guess I'm trying to be the moderate, reasonable voice here. If Anthony Fauci says that it's okay to do these things, and we have been trusting him all along. I think it can be dangerous to society to all of a sudden doubt him. So I just think that we have to consider the source, and the source is giving us some leeway to benefit from the vaccinations that we've put in our bodies.
Fair point.
It's a fair point. It's a fair point. And of course, one always asks, as we did from the time we were very, very young. And if Anthony Fauci told you to jump off the Empire State Building, would you?
No, I would not.
But it's our comfort level. I think, Bob, you were making that point. It's what, you know, if we are vaccinated and we are told by the CDC we do not have to wear a mask, we may not have to wear a mask. But if you feel comfortable doing that, good for you. If you don't, there's nothing wrong with keeping it on.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, it's just common sense. And if the mask gives you comfort, go with it. Absolutely. I mean, and other people, you know, don't listen to what other people would say about questioning you if you have it on. But that's the, I always think it's better to be overprotected than underprotected. And I think that's what the guidelines, you know, if you think about CDC guidelines, is that they're trying to tell us what the safest floor is, not what the ceiling is in that case. You know, and Rosemary, back to the sort of passive aggressiveness you saw at the restaurant. I mean, part of me is a little bit sad because, you know, I just want to remind folks, let's just be decent human beings. And if you're able to, and you're sitting and you see somebody who may need the seat, you know, if they're elderly like your mom, just be a decent human being and give them the seat and don't complain about it. I mean, just remember, we gotta be better to each other.
Yeah, you know, my first impulse when I realized what was going on was to snap at the guy that if he's so concerned, he should get up and move and let the old lady have the seat. But I didn't do that. There were children nearby. I said, I am going to display good citizen behavior. And it wasn't all that hard, as it turns out. You know, he appreciated it, and the moment passed.
Couple letters and then we'll go to a break. Karen,
it's so nice to see Rosemary grow up, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, my. The evolution of Rosemary. Karen writes, when I'm doing errands, I put my mask on before entering the first store, then just leave it on and take it off when I get home or leave the last place. It's just easier. What I don't understand is why some folks think I should take it off, put it on, take it off, put it on. And I don't understand why people are peering judgmentally through windshields anyway. Well, that's a good.
I think the point is well taken. Yeah. I wear my mask all the time, you know, under my chin. And then if I go into a market, I'm supposed to turn it up.
Move it up.
But sometimes I walk into the market and I forget that it's there. Yeah. And I forget to pull it up. And that's bad.
And that's when the society tells
you. My big offense is I go the wrong way down those one-way grocery aisles. I just keep forgetting.
Well, they seem to be a thing of the past. I noticed in our grocery store in our town, that has all been lifted. Those lines have been taken off. You don't have to do that anymore. I don't know if that's a good idea or not anymore. So
not at the big way.
Your state may vary. Yeah, I don't know how that's working. But I was surprised. I've seen a couple stores now that stuff is gone. Bob writes to us and says, "What fools we are. Look at India, Brazil, and dozens of other countries. Mm. Listen to the discussion that a mutiny might take us all down, including the vaccinated. This is a global pandemic that will not be cured until it is cured globally. Everyone on this planet should be treating it with the same degree of seriousness."
And the Indian thing is very important because, as you know, they were doing very well.
They were.
And they were doing very well, and all of a sudden, boom! And what happened there can happen anywhere else. I mean, that's the point.
We are going to take a break. Terry, did you want to say something real quick before we take so what the hell?
I think we have to be careful in how we compare ourselves to India, but it seems like we can talk about that later after the break.
Okay, great. Thank you. We will take a break.
That's my comment.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll dig into all of those sayings and utterances, and we welcome your comments as well. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Bob Griffin make up our group. Barbara, go ahead, Alan.
Can you find the letter? I don't know if you have it in front of you, from Pete. It's just come in about common sense. He takes great issue with me. Not correctly, but he does.
Common sense. From the beginning, I've used common sense to navigate my mask wearing, et cetera. What Alan says we just don't know, he's actually wrong. We do know that the virus is respiratory, which means it travels from exhales to others. We also know that all diseases depend on a viral load, and common sense would say that this acts like all other viruses. We also,
didn't I say that? That it's viral and it comes from one way and the other? You know. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'll
continue.
Finish.
Continue on.
Thank you. We also know that if we are vaccinated and get COVID, we will get sick, but almost definitely not die from it. If you could get COVID from a casual pass of someone outside, there'd be a zombie apocalypse at this point, and people would be dying left and right. So when I'm outside and casually pass someone, I hold my breath without a mask and pass by. Outside is safe for the most part. Indoor dining is obviously risky. Just use common sense, Pete.
Well, all I got to say is I hold my breath when I'm going over a bridge.
I agree with you. I do that, too. Or even worse, I just drive about 17 miles out of my way so I can avoid it. Let's see. We go to Barbara, who says,
Joe, just remember this. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean you're not being followed.
They're not out to get you.
Well,
which they are.
I don't know. You know, this is a very early memory of mine. But when I lived outside of Philadelphia, there was a bridge going from in the borough of North Wales, Pennsylvania, and there was a bridge, and it had boards on it. And I swear to God, on some days you could see the gorge that was underneath when the boards would lift up as the car passed. And that scared the hell out of me then. It still does. And I'm not real happy about that.
To say nothing of the bridge, was it Schuylerville? Where was it that went in the river?
No, that was out near. It was a western. For goodness sakes. I'll think
it's
of it.
Twin Cities, wasn't it? Are you talking about the Minneapolis?
No, we'll get 3,000. We'll get 3,000 letters on that.
And it was mentioned Schuylerville because the family that passed was from the Bacon Hill area. That was the victims of that when they went into And it was out near Oneonta, but I don't remember. Yeah, I don't remember exactly
right.
Where.
But I do remember that there was a story. I hope it wasn't just apocryphal, that it was real, or I hope it wasn't, that somebody was trying to stop traffic. And as one guy whizzed by and into the river, he gave him the middle finger. Again, back to paranoia.
Yeah. I'm looking at this real quick, but I think it's the I think it was the Schoharie Bridge.
Yeah,
Schoharie Bridge. Okay. All right, let's go to I think we have more letters. Let me quickly check that, and then we'll move on to other topics. We have a top-of-the-hour break that we have to go to. Barbara says, we know something about the lasting protection of the vaccines. Remember, these vaccines were tested last summer through last fall. So there are individuals in the clinical trials that received a vaccine almost a year ago. The companies that produce these vaccines have continued to monitor the outcomes. And in some cases, I am certain that the data is available concerning how long the vaccine is protective. I've heard seminars from individuals who have stated that vaccinated individuals in these trials are still making protective antibodies. It would be reassuring if such data were made available to the general public. Well, we talked about this yesterday.
We did.
In which we quoted both the scientist responsible for the Pfizer vaccine, who, if I remember correctly, said that he thought at least 6 months, and then the or to a year, 6 months to a year, and that you would probably need a booster, and then the head of the company saying that they believe that a 1 year booster, but they were still watching the science. So for whatever that's worth. All right. I do want to talk about, and we can certainly continue this on the other side of the break, but I do want to talk about India. Coronavirus has crushed India's health system. Patients are basically on their own. This from a report in the Washington Post, and it is a fairly dire situation, as we have noted. We've been talking about this for the past several days. And it's their second wave of coronavirus infections. Patients and their families are on their own fighting to save their loved ones in an overwhelmed system where ambulances, hospital beds, oxygen, medicine, even cremation grounds are in short supply. We also know that India's healthcare infrastructure is buckling as a record-breaking surge of infections exposes what experts say are decades of underinvestment combined with a lack of preparation by the government for a second wave. The country is reporting more than 300,000 cases and nearly 3,000 deaths a day. Official figures understate the scale of the calamity. So, Bob, well, you mentioned it, so we'll go to you first. Is Bob there?
Yo, Bob.
Do we have Bob?
Oh, I'm sorry about that.
No, that's okay.
Think about it, after a year of this, that I would remember to unmute myself. Sorry, everybody. We're talking about a global humanitarian crisis occurring in India right now. I think Terry was right, though. It's we have to be careful when we make an apples-to-apples comparison between India and the United States, and just a couple of statistics to think about. Right now, only 1.6% of the adult population of India has been vaccinated. And when you compare that to the United States, we're looking at 24.3%. I mean, so you can see that the vaccination program that that the federal and state governments have rolled out have created a really substantive difference. In India, Joe, though, it is showing a number of huge problems. The hospital system is completely overrun. The whole medical system is in tatters, and that goes also beyond the hospitals all the way to how they deal with death and burial. A couple things that I'll toss on the table. I'm looking at this and I'm really questioning what Modi has done as prime minister. I looked up the GDP for India, and they're spending over 2.4% of their GDP on defense in the military. And to give you a sense, we spend 3.4%, but the UK spends 1.7%, and China spends 1.9%. And I think part of the discussion about India, besides the humanitarian crisis, is it becomes a question about what priorities people have and where as communities we want to spend our money. At the same time, I'll toss this also up for, because I'll be interested in hearing perspectives. The situation in India just absolutely calls out for a massive international aid. And as it was noted before, a pandemic is global. And if we don't stop it in India, it's going to potentially spread and you start to think about variants. This is a bad situation.
We're going to hold it there because we have to take a break, and that's a lot of information to sort of digest. So we'll give you a minute or two to do it. When we come back, we will dive in with the rest of the panel and have our discussion on this topic and welcome your input as well. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Bob Griffin. We've been talking right before the break about the situation in India and basically the health system being in such a crisis and officials saying that people are basically on their own. Alan?
Yeah, you know, it's awful. It's just awful. Look, these are human beings, wonderful living human beings, and the question then becomes, does the United States have a responsibility to help in this kind of a great crisis? My feeling, of course, is that we do. There are other people who are surfacing who don't, who say you have to take care of your own first. But I think that Biden is on the right track. Now, we're getting people who are now saying it's not enough. What you're doing is not enough. You have to export more, and you're exporting the virus relief drug that we don't need, the AstraZeneca. So that's giving people stuff that we don't want to use. Look, there'll always be criticism in anything like this, and it's not a healthy way for us to behave.
Terry?
I do think that this is a global effort that needs to be ramped up significantly, and I do think that it's just really unfortunate that Donald Trump worked so hard to isolate our country from all the other countries, and we had an opportunity to be a leader in really reaching out and helping in this pandemic sooner and doing more to help other countries sooner, and that hasn't happened, and India is one of those that has suffered. I do think we have to be careful in comparing India to what's happening here in the U.S. I know that's come up. I mean, it's just a very different country. The population is incredibly different. There's 129 billion more people living in India than there are in the U.S. Their vaccination program has not rolled out in a successful way as it has in the U.S. Obviously, the culture in India, the healthcare system in India is very different. And they had lots of issues with their government and healthcare system long before the pandemic. But it is a crisis that needs to be dealt with because these are people that need our help. And we used to be a country that was excited about helping others. And I hope we'll get back to that.
Rosemary.
Well, in lieu of further comment, because you've all spoken eloquently about this, I want to give a reading recommendation. For preparing today, you suggested we read the Washington Post story about India. I instead looked at the New York Times story, which is astounding. It's written by the Indian bureau chief, Jeffrey Gettleman, or Gettleman, I don't know how you pronounce it, but he's like this rock star Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, and he's now stationed in New Delhi. And he and his wife and the two children are sequestered in or locked down in this tiny apartment surrounded by, you know, this huge population that Terry just spoke of. And basically, they're waiting to get sick and die because that's what's happening. It is an astounding piece about this, what we all were worried we would be facing here and across the whole world when we first heard about this virus. It's actually happened and is happening in India right now. They don't know where it's coming from because there's so many possible ways to get it. It's almost unavoidable in that massed, dense population that's very poor. the government is doing nothing. And if you do get sick, literally nothing can be done. They are airlifting oxygen, and the military is airlifting in oxygen to try to help people. There are no hospital beds. There's no there are no medical facilities. There are no doctors available. I mean, you just get sick and die. It's something out of the Middle Ages when you read it. And to me, that piece was first of all, of course, I'm a journalism teacher, so I'm going to make all my students read it. It shows the importance of being there and giving witness to what can happen if we're stupid, which we have a tendency to be. And also, it shows the connectedness of all of us. He's an American in the middle of this, and he's talking to us about what could happen to us if we don't act now. It's so compelling.
Bob?
And Joe, you know, one point that I'll go back to is this, the reference that we may be taking away from people here who need vaccines. And, you know, what we're seeing actually is just the reverse, right? We're seeing that there's more vaccines than there are people that want to take it. We're seeing vaccination sites being closed down because there's just a lack of people. I think Georgia closed six in the last week. So I want to put people's minds to rest that helping India does not necessarily create a scarcity here. And if we have it and we're not using it, I think it benefits us all to get it into the arms of people who absolutely desperately need it. You know, we have family friends. My wife has friends that she's worked with and taught in the past who are in India, and the level of despair is frankly heartbreaking. And I don't think as a country we can even get our arms around the complete breakdown of the critical infrastructure that we're seeing in India. And again, I go back to something I said earlier. This isn't just a breakdown of the health system. This is a breakdown of the government. And I think the Indian government has been very, very quiet and at a time when they absolutely desperately need help.
Terry?
Joe, I would just add to that too. One way of thinking about this as well is that long before the pandemic hit, we already globally had a water crisis, a lack of water crisis, and a lack of food crisis. And countries like India and others of that size are really suffering in those categories. And for us not to take action to help in those areas as well as this pandemic really just hurts all of us together. And I think part of the problem is it's hard for the average American to really wrap their head around how large this country is of India. One way of thinking about it is think of one of our densest areas, which is New York City, which has a little more than 8 million people in it. You could fit 16,000 New York cities into the country of India and still have even more room. I mean, it is enormous. It is enormous, and the density is enormous. And to just simply turn our backs on that many people and say somehow that just doesn't affect us is just inhumane.
Anybody else on that? All right.
No, the only other thing I'd add, Joe, is that also think about the climate. I mean, you've got people packed together, and you've got a climate that is absolutely conducive to the growth of and spread of the virus. This is a confluence of almost a perfect breeding environment for a virus.
Let's go to some other stories that we want to talk about this morning. And we go to Alan, I think, made mention of this early on, which was about about the president speaking tonight and what we're expected. His 100 days is coming up very soon. I think it's on Friday.
3 days, yeah.
Mm-hmm. 100 days. So he'll be speaking tonight in an address. And what do you expect the president, what should the president be saying, do you think, Alan?
Well, he'll be claiming credit, certainly, for the COVID thing, and he should. I mean, you know, look, the last thing he needs and that we all need is for people to say, oh, well, he solved that already, so now we have to hold him more responsible for other things. So he's going to catalog. They've been waiting for this, obviously. He's going to catalog the successes that they've had and that they hope to have. Part of the speech will be towards getting this other program passed now, and getting community colleges and pre-K and all the things that we need in this country and that we've needed for a long time, done. So there'll be a bit of a sales job. However, the Republicans, as I have said many times, all live near Oz in another country called the Land of No, and they will not be deviating from that, because these poor people, and I do have some sympathy for their mental processes, think that if that they can continue to say no, even though their people want them to say yes, so that they can politically survive.
Bob Griffin.
I think this is a great opportunity, actually, for the president, not so much to speak to Congress, but to speak to the people. I was actually heartened with sort of the outline that I saw from both the infrastructure bill, but also the safety net. And I think if anything we've seen in the last year is that we have an awful lot of work to do in this country to make sure that we're taking care of our own folks. I think education is critically important, obviously, and I mean that's what I do. But what he's laying out, what Biden's laying out, is our future. Is the step to continued prosperity and social mobility. I am looking forward to hearing from him. I would also challenge all of our political leadership on both the left and the right to, if you don't like it, what are you going to do about it? What is your plan? I mean, we have politicians in our own area that are just quick to say no, and it's either the extreme right or the extreme left, and they never present an idea of how they want to deal with continuing to strengthen our society.
Rosemary.
He's going to assure us that we can eat as many McDonald's as we want. I think that he is going to attack the attacks on him as proof that his plan of radical normalcy is intact, and it's what the country needs. And as Bob said, I think he's going to be appealing to citizens. When he has talked, we're learning, when he talks about bipartisanship, he doesn't mean getting along with the idiot senators and the Republican senators. He's talking about making a pact with Republican citizens that he is after things that they will like and that are good for them. And that includes education and childcare and a social network and all the things that will make for a stronger America in years to come. I have high hopes for this. He has trouble speaking in public. And so every word he says and how he says it is under attack from people who will say, he stutters or he's doddering. So the content has to be really strong. And he has to just do it as he has the previous big speeches he's given. He's delivered in every one when it mattered. So a lot is riding on today. His program for the future is riding on today. I think that's probably his focus, maybe even more than reminding people of what he's accomplished so far.
Terry?
Yeah, I think everybody's on the same page as I am, at least. His success, we're learning, really just relies on him being able to connect with the majority of Americans, regardless of what party they're in. It's not about connecting with Republicans in Congress. If he has the Democrats in Congress and he has the majority of people in the country, then he's going to be successful. He wants to spend a lot of money, and his job tonight is to explain to the average working American who doesn't have a lot in savings, who maybe not doesn't have a lot of job security, how this spending is going to help them individually improve their lives. If he can roll that out step by step by step, piece by piece, then he'll make a very successful speech.
Well, Terry, I have a question for you. Do you think, however, that he is not, he's up before the Congress for a reason? He needs those Republicans. And you're certainly right that he's speaking to the American people, hoping that if they put pressure on their Republican United States senators, as Rosemary describes them, if in fact he does that and they don't move off the dime, well, it may cost them at the polls. I don't know that it will. But don't you think that he is speaking to the Congress? He needs those 10 votes to bring him over the top on this new bill.
Well, I think we're learning through this reconciliation process that that is a fallback plan that will likely allow him to still get the bulk of what he wants, although some modifications will always be necessary. And
what's
I think
the fallback
that
plan?
He's willing
to
take that risk. What's
you
that?
Mean the reconciliation? You mean the reconciliation is the fallback plan?
Yeah,
I don't think he wants to
the
do
reconciliation
it.
Yeah, progress, yeah. That process we've learned is an acceptable fallback. If that's what he has to do. He'll still be able to get the bulk of what he wants. Some compromises will be made. Mm-hmm. Either way, compromises are going to have to be made. I think Joe Biden is determined to deliver a package to the American people that is going to help them and help rebuild the country, regardless of how it impacts his political future. I think he's much less concerned about his political future and is all about success on helping the people.
Bob?
Alan, I've seen some of the polling, and of course, you know, we've talked many times about the issues with polling, but at the same time, you know, these bills in the attempts are supported by I think an overwhelming number of Americans. I mean, it is kind of hard to stand against education and child care and child support, especially for every parent who dealt with COVID and realized, you know, just how much their daycare providers and educators in the school system take pressure off of them. I think part of what Biden's doing is that he's rallying people to put pressure on frankly some members of Congress and particularly in the Senate that have pretty much been able to skate on positions that do not reflect the needs or wants of their own communities.
Rosemary,
I think we're underestimating the difficulty of getting that message across. He wants to pay for this by taxing the people who support the Republican Party. So it doesn't really matter what the polls say or what the people even really truly think. The rich people do not want to be taxed more. They were very happy under Trump, and Biden would change all that. So is that going to happen? I don't know. I don't think anything he could say tonight will persuade 10 Republicans, oh, yeah, I got to vote for this. That if that's going to happen, it's going to be through wheeling and dealing behind the scene, which I hope is going on already, and involving things more than beautiful words.
I agree with you. I don't think it's going to pass. I don't think you'll get those 10 votes. They, as I say, the land of no, that's where they live.
You know, I keep going back to Martin Luther King Jr.'s comment that all too often we have socialism for the rich and rugged free market individualism for the poor. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I mean, the right will get spun up because of the very rich who are going to control the messaging. I mean, it's already happened. If you look at Ed Fox and Tucker Carlson, who I absolutely despise.
Boy, it's hard not to these days, isn't it? I mean, I never really liked the guy, but my goodness, the last couple of it's just one thing after another. It's a lot of red meat, and it's really hard to take.
Yeah.
Call the police if you see a child in a mask. That's my favorite.
Yeah. And I would, it was, I think, 2 weeks ago, but if you get a chance to see Tucker Carlson's piece, John Oliver's piece on Tucker Carlson, it's worth a view. It brings up some of the issues of his past that are quite interesting. Valerie.
It's really something that trust fund children have equated intelligence with the fact that they've inherited money. And that's not just Tucker Carlson. That's you know, Donald Jr. and Jared and a number of others.
Deep sigh. Okay.
Sorry.
Valerie said, take the air out of the room, Bob. Thanks. Valerie writes, just a note, Fox is the only major network that is not broadcasting the speech. So be surprised at that, I guess. David writes, how many of us know people who have gotten it and don't know how? It's not unusual to have heard, I did everything right and we still got COVID. Be careful out there, says David. We then get a Republican perspective from Diane. The Republicans aren't concerned about our society any more than they're concerned about our democracy, because all they care about is their party and their own power and wealth. That from Diane. Let's go to another story here. I'll make this a quick one, and then we'll leave some of the biggies for when we come back. The California recall. Gavin Newsom is in trouble. He is, as the New York Times puts it, landed in a California jam. The campaign to recall the state's governor shows that even a one-party stronghold like California can be rocked by the nation's political polarization. For all the controversies and COVID-19 crises that now have Governor Gavin Newsom of California facing a historic recall election, a court hearing and a dinner were the two biggie events that brought this to be, that led to the current political instability that will grip the state for months to come. So what do we make of the recall and what's going to happen here in California? Alan?
Well, you know, I can only tell you what I read because I don't know. I don't live there. But in fact, in California, it's relatively easy to get the signatures that you need for a recall. But the analysis that I read, and I don't remember if it was in the Post or the Times or where, indicated that he was still had enough popularity to avoid being voted out, which comes next. First, you have to have the election, and then you have whether he survives or not. Now, maybe I was reading the wrong place, but that's what I heard. One would take some, if one were the governor, one would take some solace in that, wouldn't they?
I would think so. Bob?
You know, it shows to me that as a people, what we're looking in our leadership is not arrogance and hubris, and we are certainly not looking for leaders that are telling us or creating policy that we follow that they are not. This is an absolutely self-inflicted wound. He did it, so he shouldn't have done it. More so to all other politicians is that. Even when you think that you're on easy street, the people are watching. And if you are arrogant, and if the perception is that there's that you are better than the rest of us, then you will face the exact same reaction.
Rosemary,
he's going to have to explain to people, you know, why he shouldn't be recalled. And Alan, I think you're right. I think he may have the votes, but this should be an absolute wake up call for him and a lot of other folks.
For me and for others, I wonder, Bob, if you would be so kind to just tell us exactly what he's accused of doing, because I must have missed it.
Well, I just mentioned the two. There's the two things. One was this. He told everybody not to go out and to stay home, and then he went and had a dinner.
That's Cuomo-esque.
Yeah, and so that was one of the issues, and the other was a
delay by the court so correct. That they could get more signatures because they didn't have them in the time allotted, and they went to court. These are a bunch of Trumpers, Republicans in California, went to the court and said, "We need more time because COVID meant we couldn't go out and collect names," and they got them. And at the exact same time, then comes this PR busting dinner that he has with a bunch of big wigs. So people got angry and they signed it, a petition against him, and it brings about a recall, which is very easy in California. But it's a waste of time and money, I think. The key point here is that there's not another Democrat running against him. And Caitlyn Jenner and the other bunch of Republican hooties are not going to win in California, which is what, 2-1 were Democratic? And there's no Arnold Schwarzenegger star in this race. So I think that eventually he will get back in. But yes, he's caused a furor. And California citizens apparently want to teach him a lesson to the tune of $100 million that really should have gone into education or infrastructure.
We're going to pause.
Yeah, just a couple.
Can you make the points on the other side of the break? Would be great.
We'll do.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate you for playing along with our game. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll hear Bob's thoughts on this, and we will go to other topics as well. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. First, we have a few breaks and then some news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Rosemary Armeo, Terry Gibson, and Bob Griffin make up the group. We last left with Bob about to make some points. And Bob, I return the floor to you.
Thank you, Joe. Just a couple of additional points, Alan. As I understand it, the dinner was a birthday for one of Newsom's big donors, and it was held at a place called the French Laundry in Napa, which is to any foodie is you know one of the top restaurants in the world. So you also have this issue of let them eat cake extravagance, and this certainly wasn't anything that came close to being essential. So at the same time, he's telling everybody else to sacrifice. He was giving the appearance that he was above it and he was living the high life. I mean, he really undermined his own messaging with this.
Yeah, no, I'll be honest with you, Bob. I read all of that. I just forgot it. Yeah, exactly.
Didn't Pete Buttigieg get in similar trouble for like a wine cave dinner or something in California?
And Andrew.
Yeah.
Andrew got into trouble too because he told me on that program after that he didn't come on anymore, which was that he was bringing his mother and his daughters up to the mansion after telling everybody not to go anywhere.
Well, let's not forget that it was just a few months ago that we had a president of the United States that was breaking every norm and beyond right. that we could think of, and continued to get enormous support from millions and millions of Americans. So I don't think anything that Gavin Newsom has done is going to come anywhere near him losing this recall race. And also, you can't beat someone with no one, and the Republican Party really has no one to put up against him.
I don't know.
We used to think that until we saw George Pataki.
Well, and
there was a good case of somebody being beaten by no one.
I mean, the Republican, the last one, the state was Arnold Schwarzenegger. And to Rosemary's point, so basically, Rosemary, you're saying that Caitlyn Jenner, not as big a celebrity as Arnold Schwarzenegger.
No, not as big a celebrity, not as big a draw. People will be turned off by the transgender thing. And also, she's a Trump supporter. That does not play well in California, even against a guy. I mean, come on, Newsom has always been a snob. He's always been out of touch. He is indeed a patrician. So it's he just proved true to his form. And people in California actually know that. As I say, I think they were annoyed at the egregiousness of it, and they wanted to punish him, which they did, but it was at a cost to themselves and all this distraction. It's I think it's a shame.
You say it not playing well. It's not playing well with the LGBT community, for God's sakes. Being a Republican, that is the other.
Caitlin was the one who said, oh, Donald Trump is our friend, he'll be good to us. Oh, come on. And so even among Trumpers, she's not going to be a big draw, I think. Plus, I mean, let's not leave out the fact that she has zero political experience. Great athlete, fabulous reality star. Oh, wait, that's all it takes to be president anymore. I forgot.
but don't forget, Trump was very, very good to her. I mean, his tax breaks created a huge windfall for her and her family. So in her world, Trump was great. The other thing too, Terry, you're right. I was absolutely outraged at the way Trump handled his own COVID case and how he jeopardized the Secret Service and frankly, the health of the country. At the same time, I can't excuse Newsom's behavior either. I mean, this is the arrogance of the political class, that the political class really needs to be held accountable. And in part, it is this overall arrogance that led to someone like Trump being elected.
Great point.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I mean, I don't think anybody would disagree
point.
That Gavin Newsom is arrogant. I mean, you know, he is the epitome of arrogance. It just comes across in everything that he does. But I think when the overall population of the state goes to the polls and they look at the choices and they think, well, you know, we got a lot of serious stuff going on right now. Do I want to go with the devil I know, or do I want to turn my state over to someone that has no political experience?
I mean, do I want a new devil?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd rather have an arrogant devil that at least has some sense of what it, you know, takes to manage the state. I mean, now I don't know if, you know, I don't think Gavin is in a good place to get reelected. If he's even eligible, I'm not sure. I think his days are numbered. He's definitely damaged significantly.
How do we feel about recall in general?
I don't like it. And should we have one in New York State?
Yeah. I mean,
I'm a big fan of it.
Yeah, I mean, it goes against the voters, right? I mean, this isn't what we're always yelling about. I mean, it's people voted him in, and then what? So you basically it helps with buyer's remorse.
Well, I just think we have enough trouble executing our normal elections and making it possible for people to vote and expanding voting rights and to just add another possibility of another election within an election. I think it's just incredibly problematic, and it seems to always benefit a small minority of people. And you know, you make these choices when you go to the ballot, and you have to live with your choice until the next time comes around, and you have the power during the term to put pressure on that person and other elected officials to try to make them correct their ways. But I just think the recall itself is just very dangerous.
I just think it's great to have a pressure release valve in case you have somebody who wants to do something like make sure that there isn't another election. And we think, oh, that's preposterous until you remember what happened on January 6th.
Damn good point.
Rosemary?
No, Bob said it.
Oh, okay. All right.
I think I agree with Terry, except I sure would have liked to have had a recall option under Trump at the presidential recall, different than a gubernatorial one, but still.
Put another way, do you think Andrew would survive a recall right now?
I think he would.
Yeah, I mean, again, you have the same issues, right? Who is the Republican who's going to win, and what Democrat's going to go up against him?
Letitia James could beat him.
I don't think so. Not for a minute.
I don't think she would put her name on the ballot in a recall situation, because that's the other thing. When you're in a recall situation, it's a lot harder to step up and be that person of the same party to put your name on the ballot. That's a very risky thing to do, and I don't think any of the leading candidates would be willing to take that risk.
All right.
Well, that raises the question, of course, to all of us, whether if Andrew decides to run for a second time, for another time, a fourth term, whether or not any of these people you've just mentioned, Letitia or any of the other guys, will step forward and say, okay, I'm going to primary him. I doubt it.
Well, I think there's a greater chance that some of them might, just because going head-to-head in a typical primary is very different than stepping up during a recall, where you could just lose really badly, and that would pretty much end your political career.
All right, let's go to a story I'm interested in. Well, I'm interested in everyone's perspective on this, but I do want to start with Rosemary because it has to do with the press. So a New York Post story about Kamala Harris triggered conservative outrage. Almost all of it was wrong. Now the reporter has resigned. A longtime New York Post reporter said she has resigned after being ordered, quote unquote, to write a false story that claimed undocumented minors were being welcomed to the United States with copies of a children's book written by Vice President Kamala Harris. The Kamala Harris story, an incorrect story I was ordered to write and which I failed to push back hard enough against, was my breaking point. This, according to Laura Italiano. She tweeted this Tuesday afternoon, several hours after her viral article about the books had been deleted from the Post's website and replaced with the corrected versions. Italiano, who has written for the Post since the 1990s, according to news archives, could not be immediately reached for comment. This is the Washington Post telling the story about the New York Post. And since the New York Post published the story on its front page Saturday, the conservative mediascape has been in an uproar over the supposed distribution of Harris's 2019 book, Superheroes Are Everywhere at Migrant Shelters. A slew of prominent Republicans expressed outrage over the possibility that taxpayers were funding the program. Even the White House press secretary was grilled about it. Rosemary, we'll begin with you.
Okay, so when I first heard this story, I really wanted to turn her into a hero, a heroine. I love her name. I love that she stood up for doing the right thing. However, now you read about it, and she was there for 30 years. Really, she was shocked and surprised by what happened. It's not like this is the first time that paper has pulled this sort of stunt, maybe quite not so egregiously or to her, but still, she's been in the thick of it for a long time. So what makes the difference now? I think there's more I want to hear about that. I also love that the whole thing has been outed by the Post and other newspapers. That means they are doing what they should, which is looking at an institution that has great effect on our lives. And what appears to be happening is a campaign of untruths against the current administration. And I would group this story about Kamala Harris's book with the idea that Joe Biden wants to help the climate by restricting meat consumption. Totally made up, complete falsehood, and yet presented not just in this newspaper, which has a big circulation, but not the biggest in the world, but it was on Fox. It's been picked up by conservative media. It's all over social media. And once a lie is out like this, it's very hard to stamp it out. I think that Laura has taken a step that will help stamping it out. If the author herself says it's made up and phony and I was forced to do it, that's a good step. But I'm not ready to make her a heroine yet.
That's an interesting point. I mean, she did say, however, that, you know, this was the straw that broke the camel's back. I don't know. You know, if we take her to that. Or
30
not.
Years, Joe.
I know.
Years.
I agree with you. I agree with you. I agree with you entirely. I'm just making her point. That's all.
And the other Murdoch property is not playing the president's speech tonight. The only one who isn't. Interesting. You know, it gets to be pretty offensive.
Well, and also the Fox News was the one, and Rosemary mentioned it a little while ago about burgers, but and it was a story we didn't get to yesterday. But John Roberts, the Fox, not the Supreme Court, the Chief Judge of the Supreme Court, but the reporter for America Reports on Fox, put out this whole thing that about President Biden limiting red meat consumption. That was a story that also went out. And I don't know if we expect Fox reports to be accurate anymore or not, but that caused quite an uproar until, you know, it was eventually ditched.
You know, if these are the strategies that the Republican Party and the far right are depending on to win back the White House and win back Congress, I really think that they are in big trouble, because I just don't think the average American, regardless of what party they're in, is really paying a lot of attention to these stories. I mean, it's ridiculous. And it just goes to show how desperate they are to try to find something that they can use as a message that will resonate with their base, because the current administration, as we hear over and over again, is just kind of boring. They're just not doing anything that Republicans can easily attack and build a message that's going to be successful.
Bob?
Isn't it wonderful? I love boring government. I mean, that's the way it should be. You know, I read it, and Rosemary, I agree with you. I thought it was a little bit disingenuous after decades and decades of the work they were doing. I also saw this as this is going to come back when Harris runs again. That this is the trying to lay out a narrative to be able to beat Harris in the elections. I think the big loser here is the press in general, though, because it just sort of cements in people's minds that you can't trust what you're seeing in the media, and that is not good for this country.
The stories are being ordered up. We have to end there.
Sorry.
We're out of time, Rosemary. I'm sorry. But I promise you can make the point at another time. We're out of time. We're late. My thanks to everybody. Alan, thank you very much.
Thanks, Joe.
Rosemary, Robert, and Terry, thank you. We'll be back right after this.